You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two local artists have combined their love for the Green Bay Packers with their painting skills to become local icons with their Lombardi Avenue Packers murals. We'll hear from the two of them coming up next. First, coverage for pre-existing conditions has become a big part of this year's midterm elections, with candidates up and down the ticket from both parties saying they want to protect it. In the race for governor, Democrat Tony Evers has been criticizing Governor Scott Walker for a lawsuit he okayed that's trying to strike down the Affordable Care Act as unconstitutional. Walker's solution to require a pre-existing condition coverage at the state level hit a snag yesterday when leaders of the state legislature said they weren't sure if they had the votes to support that. Donna Friedsam is a distinguished researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She also oversees the group Covering Wisconsin, which helps connect residents with insurance plans. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, it's a moving target in some ways, but right now, as of today, what does coverage for pre-existing conditions look like right now in Wisconsin?
Well, it looks the same as it looks at the national level because the protections that are extended under the Affordable Care Act are the same nationally within all the states. So insurance plans are not able to exclude people based on pre-existing conditions, and people cannot be face differential pricing based on pre-existing conditions.
So we've got this national lawsuit. Wisconsin is part of it, saying the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Hypothetically, if a court were to strike down the whole thing, what then happens to this the pre-existing condition coverage mandates?
Well, it would be a substantial change, without a doubt. If the Affordable Care Act goes away, the pre-existing conditions piece would go away along with it, and that would affect a lot of people. It would affect really virtually everybody in the state in some way. The estimates are that about 25% of the adult population in the state, or about 850,000 adults in our state, have some kind of excludable pre-existing condition. And people think of large conditions like cancer, but this can include really common conditions, asthma, depression, diabetes, those kinds of things. And a lot of people either have them or at high risk for developing these kinds of conditions. So if the existing law goes away and we don't have anything in its place, then insurance plans will have the ability to exclude those people with those conditions from coverage, or substantially increase the price for plans for people who have those conditions.
What did things look like here in Wisconsin before the Affordable Care Act when it came to these possible exclusions for pre-existing conditions?
Well, we had about twice as many people uninsured in our state that we have today. So the uninsurance rate in Wisconsin has declined about 40% since the Affordable Care Act. So we have about over 200, and I don't know the exact number offhand, but about 240,000 people have gained insurance coverage since the Affordable Care Act. But before that, also, we had a high-risk pool in the state called HRSP, and that was available for people who were otherwise excluded from coverage. But the pool was very small. The available coverage opportunities and the funding for the pool was quite limited. So at the time, even though the program operated very well for those people who were in the program, at the peak of its operation, it had about 22,000 people in it. So at that moment that it had those 22,000 people, we also had over 500,000 uninsured people in our state. So it definitely was not a broad-based solution. A lot of people still found that they weren't able to afford the coverage in HRSP, or there were various conditions around coverage in HRSP that did not necessarily meet the needs of everybody who had those conditions.
Talking to Donna Friedsam from the UW Population Health Institute about pre-existing condition coverage as it stands now under the Affordable Care Act, what might happen if that went away. And Donna, we've heard from some in the state legislature, from Governor Walker, and also at the congressional level, okay, if we get rid of the Affordable Care Act, we'll pass laws that would protect people with pre-existing coverage from discrimination. That could mean a lot of different things, right? What are some of the ranges of approaches there?
So, as usual with policy, the details are very important. And we did have a bill that was contemplated in the state legislature about a year ago. But there was some concerns because whenever we're passing laws at the state level, they don't have the full effect that federal law will have with regard to controlling health insurance. So whatever we do at the state level cannot reach many of the health insurance plans that are what we call self-insured, or the larger companies that provide health insurance to their employees, which are most of the people that get health insurance through their employers, cannot be regulated at the state level. So no matter what we do at the state level, we're not going to be able to affect pre-existing condition exclusions without some kind of federal law. That being said, what we can do at the state level with regard to pre-existing conditions, if we say we can't exclude people from coverage for pre-existing conditions, we're going to need some other provisions as well with regard to annual and lifetime limits. The Affordable Care Act says that insurance plans cannot put annual and lifetime limits in coverage. If that provision goes away, we're going to need that kind of a provision in state law so that people do not bump up against those ceilings. We'll also need various provisions around what kinds of coverage insurance plans will need to provide. So insurance plans, if they're mandated to extend coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, they could potentially decide to provide a health plan but not cover the kinds of things that someone with a condition might need in order to care for their condition. The Affordable Care Act has regulations that disallows that, so plans have to cover what people need. We'll need to take that into state law so that people can get the pharmaceuticals or the kinds of things they need to take care of their condition. So there's a lot of details we'll need to take care of in state law in addition to simply saying no exclusion for pre-existing conditions.
So hypothetically, if I'm hearing you right, you could pass a state law that says you have to provide coverage if someone with, say, diabetes applies for coverage, unless we specify it, that might not include coverage for insulin.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, now let me say this. We do have a number of pieces of state law separate from anything that happened in the Affordable Care Act. There are elements of state law that require health plans to cover certain things, certain basic things. And we do have a range of insurance mandates. But nonetheless, it is possible for health insurance companies to exclude certain kinds of prescription drugs and certain kinds of services that would potentially very significantly affect people with pre-existing conditions or potentially cause people with pre-existing conditions not to select their health plan. So it's kind of a way to segment the market and be able to have people go to other plans and not their plans.
So with those self-insuring companies that you say, no matter what the state does, these are defined under federal law, so it doesn't matter. Without the Affordable Care Act, what could one of those self-insuring companies do when it comes to pre-existing conditions?
We're going to need some federal law to step in to address the matter of pre-existing conditions for these self-insured companies. They are regulated by federal law and preempted by ERISA for state law and health insurance regulation.
So as we wrap up, Donna, there are a lot of moving parts here. When you look at the politics side of things, do you think people across the political spectrum are really looking into this level of nuance as they talk about pre-existing conditions as an issue?
Well, I think it's very difficult. Like, people know already that health insurance is very complicated. And so what they'll need to keep in mind is that when they hear somebody offer them what sounds like a simple answer, they need to keep in mind that it's not that simple. And that's why it took a while for us to get to where we are in terms of getting people covered and trying to figure out how to manage pre-existing conditions. And even now, we don't have it right. If we undo what we have, we need to figure out a different way to do it right, and it's not going to be easy.
Donna, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Donna Friedsam, researcher and director of the Health Policy Program at the UW Population Health Institute. Join us for a look at pre-existing condition coverage in Wisconsin and what could happen to it if a legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act is successful. Joining us now are two Green Bay Packer fans whose work, beginning with painting murals on fences surrounding the stadium, has made them even more a part of the pack. Spencer Young is a graphic designer and artist from Shiocton. Zane Statz is a graphic designer and painter from Green Bay. Together, they've been painting murals on fences surrounding Lambeau Field for years now. They've been dubbed the unofficial Packers artists by the Green Bay Press Gazette. Spencer, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Zane, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, let's hear the story. You're both fans. Obviously, you're both artists. Spencer, how did you end up painting these murals on Lombardi Avenue?
It's quite a funny story. I actually left my job. It was an office desk job, and just it wasn't for me. You know, it's fun working on the computer, but my real passion was painting, and I pursued this dream. And fortunately, a month went by, and Zane called me and said that there's an opportunity to paint the Packers fence, and I thought he was lying to me at first, because I remember growing up, and that was the one thing I remember was Chris Handler, the previous Packer fence painter, doing that every year. And I just told myself, man, that'd be so cool to do. And here we are. I mean, I'm living my dream right now.
And Zane, this is a lot of pressure. This is something that basically every single Packer fan is going to come in and see on game day, much less the rest of the week. Did you feel a lot of weight on your shoulders when you did that first mural?
The first one, a little bit, just because I only had 2 weeks' notice to actually paint that fence. So to come up with the design and then execute it was under 24 hours. We painted in one day. But then to do that 2 weeks before we had to do it was a little nerve-wracking. But, I mean, the first year we feel like we knocked it out of the park. And then every year after that it just got a little better.
And let's get the dimensions of the fence, Spencer, because I think people might think a fence, oh, there's a little thing along the side. This is big.
It's a large fence. If I remember correctly, it's about 66 feet long and 6 feet high.
So that's huge. How, Zane, do you plan out something like that so it's, you know, well-proportioned at that length?
Yeah, I mean, we both kind of have our own little methods that we use. Spencer uses, like, a grid. I usually use stencils that kind of are printed in large format, so I didn't know that my proportions are accurate. But it's just each year we kind of perfect our work ethic and do the best thing we can to make sure we can paint this in one day.
And Spencer,
so, I mean, go ahead.
Oh, why does it have to be one day, Zane?
That was the request of the fence owner the first year, and we kind of saw it as a challenge, and we just want to kind of keep doing that same challenge every year, because that Saturday before the first game is just one huge party down there at the stadium. So if we can kind of just get that energy from the fans and have a lot of fan stuff, that was just kind of it helps just have one big fun time.
And Spencer, there's a different theme each year. What was your theme for this season?
Well, I think the big giveaway was the 100 years you're celebrating. You got to go big, so... just planning between Zane and myself and actually the owner of the fence, we decided that it would be cool to not only step it up, but step it up big. In previous years, we painted about 2 players on the fence. This year, we painted 8. So that was a challenge. I didn't think it would be done, but the only thing that sets us up now, we got to outdo this previous year's fence and come up with something better next year. So I'm kind of worrying about it, but I'm sure we'll be able to get something done.
Now, the fence has its own Twitter page. It tweets at Packers Fence. Zane, what kind of response online or in person do you get from the fans?
I mean, each response is unique, which is kind of fun to see. But, it's a lot of this appreciation and just fan camaraderie that you see on the social media channels. So it's kind of seeing them interact and really appreciate kind of what we do. I mean, Spencer and I donated our time to do this. So then when we see all this fan reaction and how positive it is, it just kind of makes us feel good. And this is good help. The whole organization and the Packers team as well.
And Spencer, I understand you've done other, both of you, I think, have done some other Packers-themed art. What kind of stuff have you done?
It ranges. It's totally random, actually, with the projects that I've done. Actually, this season I'll be painting, for sure, 2 Packer players' cleats for Week 13's My Claws, My Cleats. I've done work for other Packer players and then just Packer fans in general. So it's always keeping me busy.
And Zane, do you get responses from the team and the organization itself?
Yeah, we have. I mean, this year Mark Murphy stopped down at the fence and talked to us for a few seconds, kind of just saying how you appreciated what we were doing. So that's pretty huge to see that and hear that from the Packers president. But yeah, I mean, players reach out and it's just a good response kind of from everyone.
Spencer, this is like an artist's dream canvas. You're doing something that a lot of people are going to see. Is it going to be hard to top this? You're young. You've got a long artistic career ahead of you.
Yeah. Each year, right before we paint the fence, I just say to myself, like, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? And each year we just manage to, you know, make something epic, you know, and each year that's our plan and that's our intention, is to make something that the Packer fan community will love and appreciate, and hopefully more people become Packer fans because of it.
And Zane, what is it like for you as an artist being able to combine your two loves, the art and your Packer fandom?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's a dream come true. It's kind of what everyone would hope to do, especially at the scale that Spencer and I are doing it. So we really love it. We hope to keep elevating that bar each year and kind of seeing where this takes us. So, I mean, it's great.
Spencer, you mentioned that you're already thinking about next year. I'm sure you don't have it locked down, and you wouldn't want to tip your hand too early, even if you did. But that said, what are you looking at for inspiration? Is there a moment? I think there was a Hail Rogers theme a couple years ago. I'm assuming that was inspired by one of his Hail Mary passes.
Correct. That the Hail Rogers fence was inspired by the previous game with the Motor City Miracle. So it had to pay homage to that. And then coincidentally, that was the first home game opener was against the Lions. So it's kind of a little burn on Lions fans there and have to relive that moment when they come to Lambeau.
And Zane, leave us with some thoughts on your Packer-themed art. Leave a message for your fans who are watching your murals each year.
No, I kind of appreciate everyone that stops out when we do these big fences. It goes a long way. And, yeah, we just keep the hope bringing new designs down there on Lombardi Avenue and keep elevating the fan experience.
All right. Zane, thanks. Good luck to you and to the team, of course, this season.
Yeah, thank you.
And, Spencer, thanks a lot for joining us in our studio in Green Bay.
Thanks, Rob. Really appreciate your time.
We've been talking to Spencer Young, graphic designer and artist from Shiocton, and Zane Statz, graphic designer and painter from Green Bay. You can check out their work, their current fence mural on Lombardi Avenue in Green Bay. It's across the street from the Lambeau Field Atrium. Spencer's work can be seen at foreveryoungdesigns.com, Zane's at zasdesigns.com, and on Twitter you can follow at Packers Fence to see what that fence is up to this time. Now, if it seems like the only thing being delivered through the mail lately is Amazon packages and bills, you might not be too far off. According to the U.S. Postal Service's statistics, the number of first-class mail items has dropped by more than 50% in the last decade. To put it another way, the average American household only gets 10 pieces of personal mail a year, aside from holiday cards and invitations. Our next guest says, amidst all the text messaging, emailing, and Facebook posting, we might benefit from sending some old-fashioned snail mail. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you still send letters and postcards to people? Do you receive them yourself? Do you think it feels different or more valued than sending a text message or an email? Do you have a pen pal, or did you have a pen pal when you were younger? Would you want one now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan Shane is a freelance writer and traveler who's been published in The Washington Post, NPR, and more. She wrote the piece, "We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now," from The New York Times. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, are you a letter writer yourself?
I am. I mean, I've always been a huge fan of postcards, cards, letters, anything like that. So I do try to write as many cards as I can. Letters, like long letters by themselves, I haven't been writing as many of those lately.
Do you feel like a rare breed in a world of email and texting?
I do. I mean, I do think that cards stand out these days, especially amongst people my age. I'm a millennial, so I wasn't a digital native. I grew up writing cards and letters to my family who live far away. But especially amongst people my age, we now just turn to text messages and emails and Facebook messages. So I do think that I'm a bit rare in that.
And when you send somebody a card or a letter, are they surprised?
Yeah, I often get, you know, I mean, the funny thing is I often get a text back that says, like, oh, my God, thank you so much for the card. It was such a fun surprise to come home to, because I think we're all so used to opening the mailbox and finding nothing but ads and bills. And when you see a little envelope sticking out there with handwriting on it, it just makes your day.
Yeah, I think back, I actually went through the box of correspondence that I had that my parents still had for some reason, and I realized in high school, man, I wrote a lot of letters back in those days, and they were all pretty boring, I think, but it really completely fell off my radar. Why do you think, is it just the technology, or have we changed? What happened?
I think it's just easier. We think it's easier to, you know, just shoot off an email or shoot off a text. But I've actually found that sending cards is actually not that hard. You just have to take a few steps to make it be as easy as email, and then you might do it more.
And when you're composing, does it feel different? Does it feel more meaningful when you're actually writing something by hand as opposed to typing or you know, putting it on your phone?
I do think so, because for one thing, you can't delete. I mean, I personally don't have any whiteout on me, and so if I write something, it's probably staying. So I think a little bit harder about what I'm going to write. And I also know that this might be something that somebody keeps for a while, whereas an email, they're just going to read it, maybe reply, and then archive it. A card might be something they put on their bulletin board or that they read over every few years.
Talking to Susan Shane, a writer. She wrote a piece in the New York Times about the lost art of writing letters and postcards instead of just sending an email or a text. You can join in if you are a letter writer or a former one. At 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jude is with us in Iola. Jude, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I feel that now everything is fast. People just want everything quick and fast. And for me, I love going to the mailbox and checking my mail and getting letters, and I also love writing them because when you write a letter, you put so much more into it because you take the time. And when I receive letters, I can feel what the person has genuinely put into the writing more than I could from, you know, from an email. And I will always be doing that. I will always be looking forward to my mail, and I'll be always ready to just sit down and answer letters and send cards. And I love to put the cards out and just leave them out so I can look at them and reread them.
And Jude, do you have people that you actually correspond with? You write them, they write you back and forth?
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Fantastic, Jude. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. And Susan, that idea of, you know, when you read biographies of famous people, they're always writing these awesome letters back and forth. And that's something that a lot of us are just totally missing out on. Not Jude, she's doing it, but a lot of us don't have that, Susan.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said in my story, you know, there's that famous website, or nowadays famous website, called Letters of Note, that kind of has all these intimate letters of people throughout history. And I just don't think that Emails of Note has the same ring, you know, because it's so exciting to see what somebody's handwriting looked like and what kind of paper they were using, and to see those ink smudges in there. I mean, that's what makes it real. And when it's just on a computer, it just doesn't seem as much of an intimate glimpse into their lives.
Thanks for calling in, Jude. And Jude also mentioned, Susan, that anticipation, like you're going to the mail and there could be something cool in there. And I got to say, when I hear the mail fall in, we've got a mail slot. When I hear the mail fall in, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, maybe there's something cool there. And there isn't, because I don't write letters. I don't get letters. So I know it's going to be advertising circulars and, you know, the utility bill or something like that. Is that part of the fun, knowing that, hey, something cool might be there?
Exactly. I mean, nobody gets excited when they get an email. An email just means something that you're going to have to work and that you're going to have to think about and reply to. It's something to get through, whereas a piece of mail is really exciting. You can look at it. You can cherish it. There's no rush to reply because somebody's waiting on you. You can take your time like Jude did and really think about what you want to say.
Let's go to another caller now. Sue is with us in Cassville. Sue, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy writing letters, postcards, probably write 4 or 5 a week, and actually have a pen pal that is a former coworker that corresponds with me and keeps me up to date with what's going on with her life. It's like getting a present in the mail, like you were saying, today there was a postcard from her, and it just kind of slows down the day for me. Sit down and take in what she shared, and it's really a great pleasure.
Fantastic, Sue. Thank you so much for sharing sharing that with us. And Susan, both Sue and Jude mentioned something, the idea of life being really fast, the letter writing and reading as a way to slow down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about the last time you sat down to write a card or a letter. I mean, you're going to be taking out a paper, and a lot of people who I spoke to thought about the idea of thinking about the person while you're writing it, you know, picturing their face while you're writing them a letter. And it's kind of a really beautiful moment to take that time out of your busy day and sit there and really give yourself over to this person while you're writing a card or a letter.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, in your piece, you wrote about some kind of famous people who are still letter writers. And you mentioned a public radio favorite, the author David Sedaris. What did he have to say about writing letters?
Oh, yeah. It was so fun to talk to him. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his writing. And so knowing that he was really into letters, he spoke to me. And I mean, obviously he was very funny, so I was laughing the whole time. But yeah, he loves writing letters. He writes them to all of his fans. He writes them to his boyfriend. And I thought this was really interesting. He writes them to everybody that he works with on a book tour. So if at a bookstore, if there's people who are helping him get set up, he writes them a letter. And he basically said, nobody else does that. And he just said, it's really classy. Real mail is classy. And he likes to be thought of as classy, and when he receives real mail from people, it's meaningful to him, and so he sends it back.
Let's bring on another caller now. Karen is with us in La Crosse. Karen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to add, I do think it's very special when, these days especially, to get a card in the mail that's handwritten. I keep cards that are special to me. I still have cards from my grandparents, you know, from before email existed yet. And every once in a while, I'll look through those and see the handwritten notes that they sent to me with their signatures on them. And it's just a very warm feeling to remember them that way and to see their own penmanship.
And are these things you're going to hang on to for a long time, a little family mementos maybe?
Oh, yeah, my kids will have to, you know, clean that out someday when I die.
That's their problem. Karen, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Though, I mean, if those kids keep it, I mean, this is pure gold for people who decide to get into genealogy and family history, Susan. So that might be a reason to save, especially some of those older, more special cards, especially from people who have passed on.
Yeah, I mean, you can really get a glimpse into their personality and see what they were thinking about, and it wouldn't be so filtered and edited as perhaps an email would. And besides, nobody's printing out emails and putting them into a scrapbook. You know, my kids aren't going to have emails that I wrote when I was in my 20s or 30s.
That's great. We're talking to Susan Shane, freelance writer. She wrote the piece, "We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now," for the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you send letters and postcards to people? Do you get letters? Do you correspond back and forth, ongoing, for weeks, maybe over the course of years? And does it feel more special than a text, an email, Facebook post? Did you have a pen pal when you were younger? Would you want one now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or write us a letter. We won't be able to get it on the air by the end of the show. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Writer Susan Shane is with us talking about the lost art of letter writing. She says, give it a try. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you handwrite letters and postcards to people? Do you get them back? What do you like about writing letters? Or do you miss maybe the old days when you used to correspond that way? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Coco is with us in Wisconsin. Coco, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I hadn't written a letter in a really, really long time. I used to write letters all the time when I lived overseas. But my son has joined the Air Force, and that's the only way I can communicate. So I am writing letters, and all of our family members are writing letters. And oddly enough, we're now writing letters back and forth to each other, all of us.
Wow. So that got you started in writing everybody.
It did.
And what's that like?
Because I wanted to make sure everybody knew. You know, it's therapeutic. It's very therapeutic.
Coco, thanks a lot for calling in. Susan, what do you think? Does it feel therapeutic sometimes to write a letter?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not just anecdotal. So in the story, I referred to a study that somebody did at Kent State University. And he found that writing letters actually, the writing letters of gratitude, they could write to anybody, the content just had to be positive. And with each letter, the writers said they experienced higher levels of happiness and life satisfaction. And the professor who ran the study told me that we all have this base of gratitude inside of us, but we have to tap into it to get its benefits. And he said that letter writing can do that for you. So it sounds like with Coco and her family, that's definitely something that's happening.
Coco, thanks a lot for sharing that story with us. Before we go back to our callers, Susan, one thing that might prevent me writing letters. I mean, when I write a card to somebody for an occasion or something, I have writer's block. There's a blank page. What do they care about? I don't know. What do we write about these days?
I mean, that's the thing. I don't think you have to overthink it. I think that might be why some people are nervous about writing letters, but just act like you're talking to the person. Just picture them in your head and write what you would say if they were sitting right there in front of you. Tell them how you feel. Tell them why you're grateful for them, whether they're celebrating something or whether you're sending sympathy. And it doesn't have to be some beautiful masterpiece. Just the act is really what counts.
I can promise it won't be a beautiful masterpiece if I write it. We'll go back to our callers. Jan is with us in Racine. Jan, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I guess I'm different than some people. I write often to people I don't hear back from. An example would be I wrote my godson when he was up in a boot camp. He had gotten into some trouble for drugs, and I wrote him often. I wrote to a Vietnam veteran who was in rehab recovering, and I never heard from her, but I told her she didn't have to. And she came back to me after about a year and was so very, very grateful. I treasure my father and mother's letters that they sent me in college. There's something about seeing their handwriting that just kind of brings them back. I currently write for some people in church who are elderly and can't write back, and also a couple of college students who are away, and they're always interesting. I don't always know what I'm going to write, but it just seems to come to me once I start, start writing something. I think that's the trick to keep going.
Jan, thank you so much for sharing that story. Jan, not expecting to get letters back, and kind of in a lot of those cases, Susan reaching out, offering some maybe consolation or a little connection to people who might not otherwise have it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to expect letters back. I mean, you're definitely going to get some letters back and some cards back. I mean, if you want mail, I always say, you have to send mail. But I mean, I think that's really beautiful that Jan is letting people know how she feels and not necessarily expecting anything back, because she can feel confident that the letters are meaningful to them, even if they're not at the point in their life where they're going to be able to respond.
Jan, thanks a lot for the call. Sharita is with us now in Madison. Sharita, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to, I love the conversation. I think it's really cool because it just kind of made me tap into what my grandma always does. She just turned 70 this year, so she's a little bit hard of hearing pretty early on, I think anyways, but she just loves to get letters in the mail. So I have my 10-year-old daughter write her 25 letters in December so that she gets something new in the mail every day. And so it's kind of hard to kind of match up the time so that it works out right, but we figured it out, so it works out really good. And she likes to practice her cursive because she loves the way that my grandma writes in cursive, and that's something that they don't really teach in school anymore, so it's a good time for both of them.
Sharita, thank you so much for sharing that sort of an advent calendar of letters. I love it. Does it matter if we write in cursive or not, Susan? I would have to do some digging deep to remember how to write that way.
No, I definitely don't think so. I loved what Sharita is doing. I think that sounds like such a beautiful idea. And I think it taps into something else, is that kids love mail and kids love replying to mail. So if you want to get some mail back, send it to a kid in elementary school and they will definitely reply. And it's a really great practice for them too. I mean, they're practicing reading and writing, and they're also just so excited when they get something in the mail. Maybe all of us are, but the kids show it more.
Sharita, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about letter writing. The people who still do it, a lot of you, it turns out. Susan Shane is with us. She wrote about this in the New York Times. Back to your calls now. Gail is on the line in Stillwater, Minnesota. Gail, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I love to write letters and cards, and often I make my own cards, and I feel like each one is a gift to the person I'm sending it to. So especially if it's family, it's a gift that they can keep. And besides my own words, it's something unique and special. I'll often use like an old paper bag that's got different things on it, or some beautiful paper that I just make into my stationery. And again, it adds interest and uniqueness, and it's my gift.
And Gail, if I can ask, what kind of things do you write? Just kind of keeping in touch. Here's what's going on in your life.
A lot of encouragement, especially to my family, my children, my aunts. Just encouragement and love. And I even wrote for 2 years to someone who was in prison who I'd never met, but I got and somebody asked me, "Would you write this person a Christmas card?" And it turned into a 2-year. Back and forth. We wrote letters back and forth for 2 years, and I saved all of his letters because they were just so special.
Gail, thanks so much for sharing that story. Susan, that's interesting. We've heard from a couple people who wrote to people at a boot camp in one case. In this case, Gail was writing in addition to family members to someone in prison. We can kind of seek out someone or an international pen pal. Is that something you've ever done?
It's not something that I've done. I do know David Sedaris did mention that he often writes to people in prison as well. He warned that the addresses are really long, was something that he said. But yeah, I mean, there's plenty of ways. If you don't feel like you have somebody who you want to write letters to, I did mention a few initiatives in the story. So there's something called More Love Letters, where you can write letters to people who need it. They kind of look through all these different candidates, and then they highlight some candidates and say, here's how you can write letters to them. And then there's Operation Gratitude, where you can write letters to people who are in the military or are first responders. And then, of course, there are programs to write to people in prison as well. So you don't necessarily need to have somebody who you think is going to reply, because there's plenty of people who would absolutely love to get a letter in the mail.
Oh, we heard from Kathleen via email. Kathleen says, I had a pen pal for 48 years. We met through a Northwoods newsletter. We correspond often. I send cards and letters often to others to keep contact and make a point to mail thank you cards. I love that idea, 48-year-long correspondence with basically a stranger she met in the newsletter. You know, pen pals used to be a bigger deal. Should we bring those back, Susan?
I mean, why not? It'd be kind of cool to learn about somebody in a different place and kind of keep track of their life. I mean, I think maybe kids are still doing it in school. I remember we did it when I was younger, but I hope kids are still doing it, because it was really exciting to read about a kid in another state. You know, you have no idea what their lives are like. So it was very cool.
Well, thanks, everyone, for all of your calls. It sounds like if you want to get letters back, write to someone in Wisconsin. And Susan, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Susan Shane, freelance writer and traveler who's been published in The Washington Post, NPR, and more. She joins today to talk about why and how we can start sending more snail mail. You can read more in her piece in the New York Times. It's called We Could All Use a Little Snail Mail Right Now. You can still share your correspondence habits. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, email ideas at WPR.org, or, yeah, you can mail. Let me get this all right. Rob Ferret, 2 R's, 2 T's. Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, WI 53706. Five? I thought it was six. I think it's six. I'm going with six. 53706, 821 University Avenue is the address. Love to hear from you.